Glad to be back tonight. Most of you know I wasn't here on Sunday because of a cold. Hopefully, it will make itself scarce during the next 45 minutes so we can get through this without any coughing outbreaks. So, tonight, I mentioned at the end of last week that we were moving on to Hebrews, which wasn't quite accurate, as you can see from your handout. We're going to do Hebrews next week, and for this week, we are looking at the book of James instead. For some reason, our textbook for this course decided that it wanted to change the order of the books, so we have followed that order in our lessons, and we are looking at James instead of Hebrews. So if you want to go ahead and turn there now, that would probably be a good idea because we are going to be looking at a lot of verses in this book. Also, we will be going to several other places. I have most of them on the slides, but in case you want to follow along, you can go ahead and be in James to begin with. The subtitle that I have assigned to this book, and we will focus on it again in our outline, is Real Faith. Real faith. And the summary is that real faith motivates us to pursue godliness instead of the natural tendencies of the flesh. And although there are many themes that we could have chosen for this book, I'm going to focus on this one, the aspect of real faith, tonight. And I think that is one of the primary topics that James is seeking to address. I think it is an overarching theme among others. For this book, he's not necessarily writing to introduce any new doctrines, although there are definitely doctrines in the book. It's much more of a practical book to teach people how their lives are supposed to be lived day by day so that they are displaying real faith in their lives. Real faith is the opposite of our natural, our physical body, what we want to do, that inertia, the flesh. The inertia in physics is defined as the tendency of any body at rest to remain at rest, or the tendency of any body at motion to remain in motion until another force acts upon it. So you're sitting in your seats right now. You're not going to just get up and float unless you actually put force into standing up. And same thing if you're running. If you're running without any kind of friction or any kind of force acting against you, then you would just keep on going and going and going until you hit something that exerted force going the opposite direction and stopped you. So real faith is the opposite of the inertia that keeps our body at rest, and it continues to push us forward, counteracting the sinful flesh that we are all subject to, which is kind of like friction, if you want to keep in that same analogy. It slows us down, trying to keep us back from where we should be. It's something that all of us as descendants of Adam are subject to because we have a sinful flesh, but it is something that we can display victory over if we exhibit real faith. One of the key questions as we look at the book of James is the author. Who wrote the book of James? Well, we know from the title and from James 1 verse 1 that it was written by a man named James. Let's go ahead and look there. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, greeting. Well, that identifies the author as a man named James. But if we look through the New Testament, there are several men that could fit that very broad description of James being their name. First, the first one we come to is James, the son of Zebedee, and the brother of John. We see him in Matthew 4:21. We find out that he became an apostle. He was part of Jesus' inner circle of disciples when Jesus was ministering on earth. And then we also find out that he was killed early on in church history by Herod. I've got some verses at the end of those. We're going to read them very quickly. Matthew 4:24, the point about who James was. And going on from thence, he saw other two brethren, James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother, in a ship with Zebedee their father, mending their nets, and he, that is Jesus, called them. When we are given the list of the 12 apostles, the 12 disciples, in Matthew chapter 10, verse 2, James also appears here. Now, the names of the 12 apostles are these. The first, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother. He was chosen as one of Jesus' disciples, and then later became an apostle. Moving on through the book of Matthew, in chapter 17, verse 1, we find that these three people, Peter, James, and John, formed an inner circle of disciples for Jesus. They were privileged to see some things that the other disciples could not see. The other disciples might have been left apart, but frequently the Gospels record that Jesus took these three men with him a little bit further into a situation. So like when he raised the girl from the dead, he took these three into the room with him. When he went up into the mountain at the transfiguration, which is what this verse is taken from, he took these three up to the mountain with him. And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John his brother, and bringeth them up into an high mountain apart from the other disciples. And Acts chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, this records the end of this man, James, his life. Now about that time, Herod the king stretched forth his hands to vex certain of the church, and he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. Now this James is a possibility for the author. He's probably the second choice, the second most commonly chosen author, because he was, in fact, an apostle. But remember, from James 1:1, we do find something that seems to possibly preclude him from that role of author. The author of James is writing to a group that was scattered abroad. So in the little description there at the beginning, James 1:1, I'll flash that slide back up here again, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. That's who this book is addressed to. But if James, the brother of John, was killed towards the beginning of the persecution here in Acts chapter 12, just a few chapters after the persecution began with Stephen's death, then very likely there wouldn't have been the structure to distribute a letter like this book of James. So there is another option that is more likely than the Apostle James. It's not this one. The second James that we see in the Bible is James the Lesser, another of the disciples who was the son of Alphaeus, in Matthew 10, verse 3. Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the publican, James the son of Alphaeus, and Lebbaeus, whose surname was Thaddeus. James the Lesser, the son of Alphaeus, was a second James who followed Jesus and eventually became an apostle, but we really don't know much about him. Although he was part of the early church and foundational as an apostle, it is unlikely that he would identify himself as simply James, a servant. And then continuing, that would not have told the recipients very specifically which James was being referred to here. Especially since there were people in more prominent positions in the early church that had the same name. The last one, I think, is the most likely candidate. James, the brother of Jesus. And we find this person first mentioned in Matthew 13, verse 55. Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And his brethren James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? James, the brother of Jesus, is probably the most likely candidate for the authorship of this book, and there are several reasons he is traditionally identified to be the author. First, a few things to note about this man. He did not follow Jesus during his earthly ministry. And I think if we imagine the family relationships between James and Jesus, we can probably come up with an idea of why that might have been. Most of us, if we have siblings, at some point have had a struggle in relating to them. Strife in the home is a normal part of family life because we live in a corrupt world. But can you imagine how irking it would have been to James to live with someone who absolutely never made a mistake? you could never be right in an argument. And that must have been irritating to him. But then after all that growing up and having some of the angst build up, not only is he perfect in your house, he then becomes famous throughout all of Israel and becomes a leading figure that people are thronging to from all over the country. And he does miracles. He becomes an object of adoration. Really, it's not really setting up to have a lot of good feelings between members of the family there, especially children. All that changed, however, after Jesus appeared to James in a one-on-one meeting after his resurrection. And we see that recorded in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 4 through 7. And that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day, according to the scriptures. And after that, he was seen of Cephas, that being Peter, then of the 12. After that, he was seen above 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain unto this present, but some are fallen asleep. After that, he was seen of James, that would be James, the brother of Jesus, then of all the apostles. This James, after the appearance of Jesus to him, became a leader in the church. Acts chapter 15, verse 13. And after they had held their peace, James answered, saying, "Men and brethren, hearken unto me." This is referring to James, the Lord's brother, since James, the brother of John, was already dead. He was martyred just a few chapters before. Paul identified this James also in his own book. In the book of Galatians, he called him a leader in the church. Galatians chapter 2, verse 9. And when James, Cephas, and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived that the grace given unto me, they gave to me and Barnabas the right hands of fellowship, that we should go unto the heathen, and they unto the circumcision. Paul had not yet begun his missionary journeys before James, the brother of John, was martyred. So Peter and John were still alive, but James, the brother of Jesus, stepped in to fill the gap of leadership in the church at Jerusalem. Incidentally, we are sure this is the brother of Jesus because Paul identified the James he was referring to as James, the brother of Jesus, earlier in the same epistle to the Galatians. Also, the author, just as a smaller note, does not call himself an apostle. If he had that role, why would he not have identified himself as an apostle in James 1:1? So the best argument could probably be made that the author of this book is James, the brother of Jesus. When did he write? After the persecution scattered the Jewish believers. We see that in chapter 1, verse 1, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, and before the Gentiles were accepted into the church. That would have been about AD 49. Since the early church was composed solely of Jews and proselytes, we could not expect to see very much information included in a letter to the Jewish church if it were written prior to the Jerusalem Council of Acts 15, which occurred sometime around AD 49. That was what we just read from when James stood up and addressed the people, asking them to listen to him. And then when Paul went to Jerusalem and talked to Peter and John and James that seemed to be pillars in the church there. That is the incident that those two references are pointing back to. We don't have an exact date for this writing, but most likely it would be sometime between these two events, so between AD 44 and AD 49. To whom did James write? We've already discussed this a little bit as we've gone. The persecuted Jews that were scattered around the area. In chapter 1:1, he says the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. In chapter 1, verse 2, which let's go ahead and read this. Chapter 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. My brethren is used in verse 2 here in chapter 1 and many other times throughout the epistle. That would have been a term that a Jew would have used for other Jews, not for a Gentile, especially at the beginning of the church age there. Assembly, then, this is another good argument that this was addressed to the Jews, and primarily the Jews. If we look at chapter 2, verse 2, For if there come unto your assembly a man with a gold ring and goodly apparel, and there come in also a poor man in vile raiment, and we'll actually read these verses a little bit later, I believe. But assembly is the word for synagogue, which was the place where the Jews worshipped. So the target audience is definitely Jews, and the Jews that were scattered by the persecution from Herod shortly after the day of Pentecost and Stephen's death. Let's take some time to look at an outline of this book now. Again, our theme is real faith. Real faith. James begins with a very short introduction, identifying himself and also the people he is writing to in 1:1. But very quickly, he begins with his first observation about real faith. Real faith rejoices in trials. But the lack of faith cannot see over the obstacles. And as we go through each of these points, I'd like us to look at several key verses, I think, that describe James' emphasis about these points of real faith. And the key verses here are verses 2 through 4 in chapter 1. My brethren, count it all joy when ye fall into diverse temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. But let patience have her perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. Faith rejoices in trials because it sees that patience will develop from the trial that it is going through. Whereas, conversely, if there is no faith, then the trial will become a daunting mountain that it will be very difficult to get over. God does allow trials into the lives of Christians so their faith and their patience can be built. Real faith, the second thing that he brings up, real faith endures temptations. In chapter 1, verses 9 through 16, faith endures temptations, but the lack of faith succumbs because it does not recognize and deal with the source of the temptations. Let's look at verses 13 through 15. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. Whenever a temptation to sin comes, we have no right to point back at God when we fall and say, I fell because God allowed me to be tempted. God does not tempt people with evil. That's what verse 13 says. He is not tempted with evil himself. Why would he tempt us with evil? We are tempted when we allow ourselves to be drawn away by our own lusts, the lusts that are in our heart. And when those entice us and draw us away, then we fall into sin. If we deal with the lusts that are in our heart that then draw us away and cause us to sin, then we will not be succumbing to that sin. We will endure the temptations. The next point, real faith changes a person. Chapter 1, verses 17 through 27. Faith changes a person who is a doer of the word. But it will never change a person who is just a hearer, because the hearer doesn't want to change. This is the image of a man looking into a glass in the morning, seeing himself, and seeing that there is something that needs to be changed, and then thinking, oh, well, I'll get it later, maybe. And then going his way and forgetting it. That's a hearer. But the doer is the one who looks in the mirror and says, oh, I need to fix that, takes the time to fix it right then, doesn't procrastinate, and takes care of it right away. The key verses in this section are verses 22 and 23. But be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass. For he beholdeth himself and goeth his way, and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he was. But whoso looketh into the perfect law of liberty, continuing therein, he being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his deed. A faithful man, the man who is a doer of the word, will change. Real faith changes the person. Moving on to chapter 2, real faith does not have respect of persons. This term, respect of persons, means that you look at somebody's outward appearance and see that they have value because of money or external goods without looking at the person themselves. Respect of persons places a person with high monetary value above somebody who is maybe poverty-stricken simply because they want the money. They see the money. Real faith does not do that. Real faith looks at all people equally because all are equal in Jesus. And the key verses here, chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. My brethren, have not the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with respect of persons. For if there come unto your assembly a man with a gold ring in goodly apparel, and there come in also a poor man in vile raiment, and ye have respect to him that weareth the gay clothing, and say unto him, sit thou here in a good place, and say to the poor, sit thou there, or sit here under my footstool. So we cannot give respect simply because somebody has money. That is not a demonstration of real faith. That is a demonstration of just carnal thinking. The next point, real faith is proven by works. And this is a big one. We're going to come back to this one a little bit later when we go through challenges to the book of James. There's some interesting stuff about this one in chapter 2, verses 14 through 26, looking back at the book of Romans, which we discussed many weeks ago now. But we are going to come back there in a few minutes. Real faith also controls the tongue in chapter 3. Real faith controls the tongue, but those who cannot control the tongue are controlled by it. The key verses here, chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. The tongue is a fire. You know, that's a great image for the tongue, because a sound is just a sound. It has meaning because there are words in the sounds. But then when you string words together and you get meaning that is tearing somebody else down, even though it's just a little thing, a little movement in your eardrum, that sound can cause a great problem, not just for another person, but it can even divide churches. The tongue is a fire. And if the tongue is allowed to run rampant, it'll defile the whole body, according to verse 6. It'll set on fire of hell. Real faith seeks peace. Chapter 3, verses 18 through 4, 6. Real faith seeks peace, but those who do not display their faith are prone to display envy and strife. Looking at verse 16 through 1 of chapter 4. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war in your members? Real faith seeks peace, but those who do not display peace cause all kinds of problems. Those who do not seek peace cause all kinds of problems. Maybe it's because of the tongue. It's leading right off of that. That's the previous topic. He could be talking about the tongue causing wars, strifes in the church. Real faith also submits to God. In chapter 4, verses 7 through 17. Real faith submits to God, but those who do not display their faith will continue in their sin. Verses 7 and 8 and verse 17. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. In verse 17, therefore, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Real faith submits to God. If you know what God wants you to do, you need to do it. That's part of looking in the mirror, seeing the image that you are, and seeing what needs to change, fixing it, and then going on your way. If you look in the mirror, you see what's wrong, you know the good. If you then go your own way and don't change, you knew to do the good, but you didn't do it. That is sin. And you're not submitting to God. You're not displaying real faith. Real faith also will wait for the second coming. The last chapter here, chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. The obvious opposite to that is that those who live without faith will spend their lives laying up treasures here on earth, forgetting that there is a life after this one in which they will give an account for their actions. Let's look at verse 5 and 7 through 8 of chapter 5. Ye have lived in pleasure on the earth and been wanton. Ye have nourished your hearts as in a day of slaughter. Be patient, therefore, brethren. Oh, just a second. I need to say something before we move on. That verse 5 is addressed to the rich men who have caused all kinds of grievances against the poor simply because they wanted to amass wealth for themselves. That is the condemnation and the description of their actions. Verse 6, ye have condemned and killed the just, and he doth not resist you. But in verses 7 and 8, this is addressed to people who are displaying real faith. Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and hath long patience for it, until he receive the early and latter rain. Be also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. Patience requires faith. Real faith allows you to live patiently, even in the midst of hardships, while you are watching for the second coming. Two more points about real faith in this book. Real faith prays fervently. Conversely, an absence of faith will not see the need for prayer. The key verse there is chapter 5, verse 15. And the prayer of faith shall save the sick, and the Lord shall raise him up, and if he hath committed sins, they shall be forgiven him. So by praying fervently, faithfully, a lot can be done. That would never have been done if we had avoided the prayer. And the last thing, real faith is zealous for others, realizing that it can make a difference in the lives of those who are straying. Chapter 5, verses 19 and 20. Brethren, there's that word again, indication of the Jewish address, people receiving this. If any of you do err from the truth and one convert him, let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. This last one, the opposite is just given by the description of what the real thing will display. Real faith will be earnest for those who are straying. Those who are straying are the ones who do not have the faith. So in the book of James, we see real faith, if you look back at our summary, compared and contrasted with how the natural tendencies of your flesh will make you want to live. Real faith exercises you more profitably unto godliness. But now we're going to go back to that one that we skipped. The concept of real faith is demonstrated by your works. And with a key question here, how do you resolve the difference in emphasis between Romans and James? The Reformers cried sola fides, which means only faith. They were coming out of the Catholic Church, where works were a big deal. Works were what the Catholic Church decided was the means to get grace. So when they cried only faith, they were turning away from their past of works, and they were focusing on faith and receiving grace from God for salvation. Galatians 2, verse 16. Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ, even we have believed in Jesus Christ that we might be justified by the faith of Christ, and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. Working after the law will not justify people or not get people saved. And when Martin Luther, who was one of the leading reformers, looked at this book, he called it a right strawy epistle because it contrasted with what they were looking at in the earlier parts that emphasized faith instead of works, which is right. Are they both right? Yes, they are. We are saved by faith, not by works. That is absolutely true. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. Let's look at those verses. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. For by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. Our faith is what saves us with God's grace. We believe in God. God gives us grace. We are saved. We are not saved by works. That much is clear. But our works do show our faith. James chapter 2, verses 18, 22, and 24. Yea, a man may say, thou hast faith, and I have works. Show me thy faith without thy works, and I will show thee my faith by my works. You know, there's a concerning trend in some branches of Christianity today where people think they don't have to change their lifestyle once they're saved. They just claim that they have faith. Their works don't show it, but they say they have it. Well, how are you to know? That's what James is saying. You don't know. They can say it all they want. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Real faith demonstrates itself through works. In verse 22, seest thou how faith wrought with his works, speaking of Abraham and offering Isaac his son on the altar in obedience to God's direct instruction? Seest thou how faith wrought with his works, and by works was faith made perfect? Verse 24, ye see then how that by works a man is justified, and not by faith only. We are saved by faith, not by works, absolutely. But our works show the true temper of our faith. Let's move on now to our final point in this outline for tonight. What is a key theme in the book of James? And really, there are many that we could address here. We could look at the tongue. We could look at works a little bit more. We could look at any number of things. I'm going to focus on patience. I think it leads into a good application for us tonight. What is the relationship between faith and patience? When you're going through something hard, it can seem very difficult, but you learn patience as you continually demonstrate faith through that hardship. Without patience, your faith will not grow, and your faith will demonstrate itself with patience. We learn patience through our trials. Many of the displays of faith that James discusses in this book of James can be lumped under this one overarching key theme, this one word, patience. We learn patience through our trials first, in verse 3 of chapter 1. Knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. When we go through something that is hard, it stretches our faith. We want to get out of hardship quickly. That's normal. That's a normal part of human nature. But sometimes God just will not allow us to. In his wisdom, he knows that the hardship is better for us than getting out quickly. Sometimes that hardship is just what we need to build the sterling quality of patience in our lives. But we are only going to build that patience if we have faith that everything he does will work together for good to those who love God. Romans 8:28, all things work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to his purpose. We learn patience through our trials. Patience is also brought up again in the second half of chapter 1. We learn patience by being doers of the word. 1:22. But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. How is that patience, you might ask? Well, being a doer of the word takes a lot of work. Consistency in fighting the natural tendencies of your flesh to slow down in your fire, your zeal for something over time, it takes a lot of work to counteract that natural friction. It's always easy to get all fired up about something at first, but then, you know, as time goes on, it's like a new exercise regimen. First day, you're great. You do it perfectly. The second day, you're sore, so you do it, but it's hard, and it doesn't feel as good as it did the first day. And the third day, you really don't want to get out of bed. The fourth day, forget it. I'll sleep another 45 minutes. And then by the time, before you know it, 3 weeks later, you forgot you were even supposed to be doing your exercises. Same thing with looking into the perfect law of liberty. Looking into the Bible and digging truth out of it is a daily discipline that takes a lot of work. It's not something that can be done quickly. It's something that we need to do methodically and carefully, meditating on the truths that we find in it, and then applying them to our lives. It takes a lot of patience and perseverance to be a doer of the word. And this is a kind of testing for us that we can gain patience as we go through. Another aspect of patience, just pulling a few out here in this book, we learn patience by bridling our tongues. James 3, verse 2. For in many things we offend all. Everyone's guilty of this at some point. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. If you're one little member, your tongue, which is so small, you can control that one little member, then James says that you can control your whole body. I'm sure we've all been at that point where we just say something and before we realize it, and then we wish, oh, I really want to pull that back in. But it's too late the minute it's said. Your tongue has a mind of its own sometimes. And we really just want to unleash a tirade against somebody that will cut them down to size because we think we know way better in our pride. I think we would agree. Controlling our tongues is just something about it that is so difficult to do. And James says it here. If you can control your tongue, you can control your whole body. The tongue is only one symbol of our rebellious sin nature, however. And if we are going to exert control over it, it requires patience as a form of a test and a difficulty here in the life of a Christian that is very difficult to overcome without patience and assistance from God. And it's necessary in order to become more like Christ. Oh, and looking back at what we said earlier about James being the brother of Jesus, he probably had a really good example of that. If someone can control his tongue, he is a perfect man, able to control the whole body. He never would have heard something mean or angry from Jesus. Been so uncharacteristic of anybody he would have ever interacted with. So then controlling the tongue would have been very much a part of perfection to what he knew himself, having grown up with Jesus. Also, last thing, we learn patience as we wait for the second coming. Chapter 5, verses 7 and 8. Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and hath long patience for it, until he receive the early and latter rain. Be also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. We sow a lot during our lives, but just like a farmer has to wait until the harvest to see the fruits of what he has sown, we need to wait until the second coming before we can see the fruits of our actions. But as we wait, we must be patient. We must ground our hearts in the firm faith. We're coming back there again to the theme of the book. We must ground our hearts in the faith that Jesus Christ is in fact coming back. And as we establish ourselves and we are patient and waiting for the true coming of the Lord, which we are guaranteed is going to happen, and since this was written nearly 2,000 years ago, we're 2,000 years closer now than we were then. We must surely be getting even closer to that time now we can be sure, even more sure, that our patience is getting stretched and that our thing that we are waiting for, the coming of the Lord, is coming closer. So I'd like to leave us with a final application tonight as we close out this book, pulled right out of that last demonstration of patience. Wait patiently for the coming of the Lord. It's the same overall application that James ended his book with. Wait patiently for the coming of the Lord. Be established in the truths of the Bible. He is coming again, and I think he is going to come much sooner than we realize. Maybe even tonight. I think this is the confidence that we can have that will help us to live with patience as we go through hardships in this life. Live with the light of eternity illuminating your life. Let's resolve to wait patiently, to let patience have her perfect work in our lives as we wait for the coming of the Lord. That is our lesson for the book of James tonight. Thank you very much for coming. Let's divide up for prayer.